Certainly not.
Because that would be strange and irrational, wouldn't it?
Very much so.
No, I think he takes on each in turn, and loses it in turn.
I'd agree.
And the same with strength and weakness.
Yes.
And speed and slowness.
Certainly.
And good things and happiness, and their opposites, bad things and misery. Does one take these on in turn and get rid of them in turn?
Entirely so, I should think.
So if we find some things that a person gets rid of and has at the same time, clearly those wouldn't be the good and the bad. Do we agree on that? Consider it carefully before you answer.
I agree completely.
Now let's go back to what we agreed earlier. Did you say that being hungry is pleasant or painful? I mean hunger itself.
Painful, I'd say, though eating while hungry, that I call pleasant.
I understand, but hunger itself is painful, isn't it, or not?
I'd agree.
And thirst, too.
Very much so.
Shall I ask more questions, or do you agree that every lack and every appetite is painful?
I agree, just don't ask me any more.
Very well. And drinking while thirsty, you say that's pleasant.
I do.
Now in what you're describing, the thirsting part is surely something painful.
Yes.
And the drinking is a filling of the lack and a pleasure.
Yes.
So with respect to the drinking, you say there's enjoyment.
Certainly.
While thirsty.
I'd agree.
While in pain.
Yes.
Do you notice what follows, that you're saying a person feels pain and pleasure at the same time, when you say he drinks while thirsty? Doesn't this happen at once, in the same place, and at the same time, whether you're talking about the soul or the body? I don't think it makes any difference. Is this so or not?
It is.
And yet you say it's impossible for a person to be doing well and doing badly at the same time.
Yes, I do.
And you've agreed that a man in pain can also be feeling pleasure.
So it appears.
Then feeling pleasure isn't the same as faring well, and feeling pain isn't the same as faring badly. So what's pleasant turns out to be different from what's good.
I don't know what tricks you're playing at, Socrates.
You know perfectly well, Callicles, you're just putting on airs. Go on a little further, since you're being coy on purpose, so you can see how cleverly you're lecturing me. Doesn't each of us stop being thirsty at the very same moment we start feeling pleasure from drinking?
I don't know what you're talking about.
No, please, Callicles, answer, for our sake too, so the argument can be brought to some conclusion.
But Socrates is always like this, Gorgias. He asks about small, worthless things and refutes people on them.
What difference does it make to you? It's not your reputation at stake here, Callicles. Just let Socrates refute whatever he wants, however he wants.
Go on then, ask your small, narrow little questions, since that's what Gorgias wants.
You're a lucky man, Callicles, to have been initiated into the great mysteries before the small ones. I didn't think that was even allowed. Now pick up where you left off and answer. Doesn't each of us stop being thirsty at the same moment we stop feeling pleasure?
Yes.
And the same with hunger and the other appetites and pleasures. They stop together.
That's so.
And pains and pleasures stop together too.
Yes.
But goods and evils don't stop together, as you agreed earlier. Or do you no longer agree?
I do agree, so what follows?
It follows, my friend, that goods aren't the same as pleasures, nor evils the same as pains. One pair stops together, the other doesn't, since they're different things. So how could pleasant things be the same as good things, or painful things the same as bad things? And if you like, look at it this way too. I don't think you'll agree here either, so pay attention. Don't you call people good because good qualities are present in them, the way you call people beautiful because beauty is present in them?
I do.
Well then, do you call men good when they're foolish and cowardly? Just now you were saying the good men were the brave and the sensible ones, or don't you call those men good?
Certainly I do.
Well, have you ever seen a foolish child feeling pleasure?
I have.
And have you ever seen a foolish grown man feeling pleasure?
I suppose I have, but what of it?
Nothing, just answer.
I've seen it.
And a sensible man, in pain and in pleasure.
Yes.
Which feel pleasure and pain more intensely, the sensible or the foolish?
I don't think there's much difference.
That's enough for our purposes. Have you ever seen a cowardly man in war?
Of course.
Well then, when the enemy retreats, who seem to you to feel more pleasure, the cowards or the brave men?
Both, I'd say, or if not, about the same.
It makes no difference. So the cowards do feel pleasure.
Very much so.
And the foolish too, it seems.
Yes.
And when the enemy advances, do only the cowards feel pain, or the brave too?
Both.
Equally.
Perhaps the cowards more.
And when the enemy retreats, don't the cowards feel more pleasure?
Perhaps.
So both the foolish and the sensible, both the cowardly and the brave, feel pain and pleasure in much the same way, as you say, though the cowards more so than the brave.
I'd agree.
But the sensible and the brave are good, and the cowardly and foolish are bad.
Yes.
So the good and the bad feel pleasure and pain in much the same way.
I'd agree.
Then are the good and the bad good and bad in much the same way? Or is the good man even more good, and the bad man even more bad?
By Zeus, I have no idea what you're saying.
Don't you know that you said good men are good because good things are present in them, and bad men bad because bad things are present in them, and that the good things are pleasures, and the bad things are pains?
I did say that.
Then don't good things, pleasures, belong to those who feel pleasure, given that they do feel pleasure?
Of course.
So those who feel pleasure are good, since good things are present in them?
Yes.
And what about those in pain? Don't bad things, pains, belong to them?
They do.
And you say people are bad because bad things are present in them. Or do you no longer say that?
I do say it.
So whoever feels pleasure is good, and whoever feels pain is bad?
Certainly.
And the more pleasure or pain, the more good or bad. And where it's about the same, they're about equally good and bad.
Yes.
But haven't you said that the sensible and the foolish, the cowardly and the brave, feel pleasure and pain in much the same way, or even the cowards more so?
I have.
Then let's work out together what follows from what we've agreed, for they say it's worth stating and examining fine things twice, even three times over. We're saying the sensible and brave man is good, yes.
Yes.
And the foolish and cowardly man is bad.
Certainly.
And again, the man who feels pleasure is good.
Yes.
And the man in pain is bad.
That follows.
And the good man and the bad man feel pain and pleasure alike, though perhaps the bad man even more so.
Yes.
Then doesn't the bad man turn out just as good as the good man, or even more good than the good man? Doesn't this follow? Along with everything we agreed before, if someone claims the pleasant and the good are the same thing? Isn't this unavoidable, Callicles?
I've been listening to you for a while now, Socrates, agreeing along the way and thinking to myself, whatever concession someone tosses you, even in jest, you seize on it gladly, the way boys do. As if you really believe that I, or anyone else, doesn't think some pleasures are better and some worse.
Oh, Callicles, what a rascal you are, treating me like a child, first telling me things are one way, then another deceiving me. Though I didn't imagine at the start that you'd deliberately deceive me, since I took you for a friend. But now I've been fooled, and it seems I must, as the old saying goes, make the best of what's given and accept this gift from you. So what you're saying now, it seems, is that some pleasures are good and some bad, is that right?
Yes.
And the good ones are the beneficial ones, the bad ones the harmful ones.
Certainly.
And beneficial means producing something good. Harmful means producing something bad.
I agree.
Do you mean something like this? Take the bodily pleasures we were just discussing, in eating and drinking. Among these aren't some which produce health in the body, or strength, or some other bodily excellence good, while their opposites are bad.
Certainly.
And likewise with pains, some are useful, some harmful.
Of course.
So we should choose and pursue the useful pleasures and pains.
Certainly.
But not the harmful ones.
Clearly not.
Because, if you remember, Polus and I agreed that everything should be done for the sake of the good. Do you agree with this too, that the good is the end of all our actions, and that everything else must be done for its sake, not the good for the sake of everything else? Do you cast the deciding vote with us, making it unanimous?
I do.
Then everything else, including pleasant things, must be done for the sake of good things, not good things for the sake of pleasant things.
Certainly.
Now, is it within anyone's ability to pick out which pleasant things are good and which are bad, or does that take an expert in each case?
An expert.
Let's recall what I was saying earlier to Polus and Gorgias. I was saying, if you remember, that some practices aim only at pleasure, providing just that and nothing more, without knowing better from worse, while others know what is good and what is bad. And I put cookery among the former, as a knack rather than an art concerned with pleasures, and medicine among the latter, an art concerned with the good. And by the god of friendship, Callicles, don't think you need to joke around with me, or answer however it happens to strike you against your real opinion, and don't take what I say as a joke either. You see that our whole discussion is about this, and what could a person with even a little sense take more seriously than this? How one ought to live? Should it be the life you're urging on me, doing the things of a real man, speaking in the assembly, practicing rhetoric, engaging in politics the way you people do now, or this life spent in philosophy? And what actually distinguishes the one from the other? Perhaps the best approach, as I tried to do just now, is to separate them out, and once we've made the distinction and agreed with each other that these are indeed two different lives, to examine how they differ and which one should be lived. Perhaps you don't yet see what I mean.
No, I don't.
Then I'll put it more clearly. Since you and I have agreed that there is such a thing as the good and such a thing as the pleasant, and that the pleasant is different from the good, and that each of them involves some pursuit and preparation for acquiring it. The hunt for the pleasant on one hand, the hunt for the good on the other. First tell me whether you agree with this much or not. Do you agree?
Yes, that's what I say.
Come then, confirm for me what I was also saying to these men, whether it seemed true to you at the time. I said that the art of cooking seems to me not to be an art but a knack, whereas medicine is an art, on the grounds that medicine has examined the nature of what it treats and the reasons behind what it does, and can give an account of each of these things, while the other, wholly devoted to pleasure, approaches its task with no art at all, having examined neither the nature of pleasure nor its cause, keeping hold of nothing rational, so to speak, working purely by routine and habit, preserving only a memory of what usually happens, and by that means supplying its pleasures. So consider first whether this seems adequately said, and whether there are similar pursuits concerning the soul as well, some artful showing forethought for what is best for the soul, and others neglecting that, focused only, as in the bodily case, on the soul's pleasure, on how it might arise, without ever considering which pleasures are better or worse, caring for nothing except gratification, whether for better or worse. To me, Callicles, such practices do exist, and I call this kind of thing flattery, whether it concerns the body or the soul or anything else where someone tends to pleasure without regard for what is better or worse. Now do you share this view with us on these matters, or do you disagree?
I don't disagree, I concede the point, so the argument can be brought to its conclusion, and I can do Gorgias here a favor.
And does this hold true for one soul only, or not for two or many?
No, it holds for two, and for many as well.
And is it possible to gratify a whole crowd at once, with no regard at all for what's best?
I suppose so.
Can you name the practices that do this? Or rather, if you like, as I ask, tell me yes for whichever seems to you to be one of these, and no for whichever doesn't. First, let's look at flute playing. Doesn't it seem to you to be just such a thing, Callicles, pursuing only our pleasure and caring for nothing else?
It seems so to me.
And all the similar arts too, like playing the lyre in competitions.
Yes.
And what about the training of choruses and the composing of dithyrambs? Doesn't the same thing seem true to you there too? Or do you think Synesia's son of Meals gives any thought to saying something that will make his audience better people, rather than something that will please the crowd of spectators?
That much is obvious about Synesia's Socrates.
And what about his father Meals? Did he seem to you to play the lyre with an eye to what was best? Or did he not even aim at what was most pleasant? He used to annoy his audience with his singing. But look at it this way, doesn't the whole art of lyre singing and the composing of dithyrambs seem to you to have been invented for the sake of pleasure?
It does to me.
And what about that solemn and marvelous thing, the composing of tragedy? What is it so serious about? Is its aim and its whole effort, as you see it, simply to gratify the spectators, or does it also fight against them, so that if something is pleasant and gratifying to them but rotten, it won't say that, while if something happens to be unpleasant but beneficial, it will say and sing that, whether or not they enjoy it? Which way does the composing of tragedies seem to you to be arranged?
That much is obvious too, Socrates, that it's aimed more at pleasure and at gratifying the spectators.
And didn't we just say, Callicles, that this sort of thing is flattery?
Certainly.
Well then, if someone were to strip away from all poetry its melody, its rhythm, and its meter, wouldn't what's left just be speeches?
It would have to be.
And these speeches are addressed to a large crowd, to the general public.
I'd agree.
So poetry is a kind of public speaking.
So it seems.
And public speaking would be a form of rhetoric. Or don't you think the poets are practicing rhetoric in the theaters?
I do think so.
So now we've discovered a kind of rhetoric addressed to a public made up of children and women together with men, both slaves and free people, a kind we don't much admire, since we're calling it a form of flattery.
Certainly.
Very well, and what about the rhetoric addressed to the Athenian public, and to the other publics of free men in the various cities? What do we say that one is? Do the orators seem to you always to speak with an eye to what is best, aiming at making the citizens as good as possible through their speeches, Or are they too bent on gratifying the citizens, neglecting the common good for the sake of their own, treating the public like children, trying only to please them, and not caring at all whether that makes them better or worse?
That's no longer a simple question you're asking. There are some who say what they say out of genuine concern for the citizens, and there are others of the sort you describe.
That's enough for me. If this too turns out to be twofold, then one part of it would be flattery and shameful public speaking, while the other would be honorable, the part that aims at making the citizens' souls as good as possible and fights hard to say what is best, whether or not it turns out pleasant to the audience. But you've never yet seen this kind of rhetoric. Or if you can name one of the orators who was like that, why haven't you told me who he is?
But by Zeus, I can't name a single one of today's orators for you.
Well then, can you name one of the old ones, someone the Athenians can credit with having made them better, from the time he began speaking in public, when before that they were worse? I myself don't know who that would be.
What don't you hear about Themistocles, that he was a good man, and Cimon, and Miltiades, and this Pericles who has just recently died, whom you yourself have heard?
If that excellence you were talking about earlier is the true one, Callicles, filling up one's own desires and other people's, well and good. But if it isn't, and instead it's what we were forced to agree to later, that satisfying some desires makes a person better, and satisfying others makes him worse, and that this is a skill, then I can't say that any of these men was that sort.
But if you look properly, you'll find one.
Let's look then, calmly, and see whether any of them turns out to have been like that. Come now, won't the good man, the one who speaks with a view to what's best, say whatever he says not at random, but looking towards something, just as all the other craftsmen, each looking to his own work, doesn't pick things out at random to bring to his work, but aims at giving what he's making a certain form. For instance, if you're willing to consider painters, builders, shipwrights, all the other craftsmen, whichever you like, how each of them puts each thing he places into some order, and makes one part fit and harmonize with another, until the whole thing stands together as an ordered, well-arranged piece of work. And the other craftsmen do this, including the ones we were just discussing, those concerned with the body, trainers and doctors. They too give the body order and arrangement in some way. Do we agree this is so or not?
Let it be so.
Then a house that has order and arrangement would be a good house, and one lacking order would be a poor one.
I agree.
And isn't the same true of a ship?
Yes.
And surely the same is true of our bodies too.
Certainly.
And what about the soul? Will it be good if it lacks order, or if it has some order and arrangement?
Given what we said before, this too must follow.
So what is the name for the thing that arises in the body from order and arrangement?
I suppose you mean health and strength.
I do. And what, in turn, about the thing that arises in the soul from order and arrangement? Try to find the name and say it, as you did there.
Why don't you say it yourself, Socrates?
Well, if you'd rather, I'll say it, and you, if you think I'm putting it well, say so. If not, refute me and don't let it pass. It seems to me that the name for the orderly conditions of the body is healthy, and from this health arises in it, along with the rest of the body's excellence. Is that so or not?
It is.
And for the orderly and arranged conditions of the soul, the name is lawful and law, and from this people become law-abiding and orderly, and these things are justice and self-control. Do you agree or not?
Let it be so.
So won't the orator we're describing, the one who is skilled and good, look to these things when he brings his speeches to bear on people's souls, and in all his actions too? And if he gives some gift, he'll give it. And if he takes something away, he'll take it, always keeping his mind fixed on this. that justice should come to be in his fellow citizens' souls and injustice be driven out, that self-control should come to be in them and lack of self-control be driven out, and that the rest of excellence should come to be in them and vice depart. Do you agree or not?
I agree.
For what good is it, Callicles, to give a sick and poorly conditioned body plenty of food, or the most pleasant food or drink or anything else, if it will do it no more good, and by strict reckoning, even less good than the opposite would? Is that so?
Let it be so.
For I don't suppose it profits a person to live with a poorly conditioned body, since that necessarily means living poorly as well. Or isn't that so?
Yes.
And as for satisfying one's appetites, for instance, eating as much as one wants when hungry, or drinking when thirsty, doctors generally allow this to a healthy person, but to a sick one, they practically never allow him to fill himself up with what he desires. Do you agree with this too?
I do.
And isn't the same true, my good man, of the soul? As long as it's in a bad state, senseless, undisciplined, unjust, and impious, it must be held back from its appetites and not allowed to do anything except what will make it better. Do you agree or not?
I agree.
For that is surely better for the soul itself.
Certainly.
And isn't holding it back from what it desires the same as disciplining it?
Yes.
So being disciplined is better for the soul than lacking discipline, just as you were assuming a moment ago.
I don't know what you're talking about, Socrates. Ask someone else.
This man can't stand being helped, even while he himself is undergoing the very thing we're discussing, being disciplined.
And I don't care in the least about anything you're saying. I was only answering you as a favor to Gorgias.
Very well. What shall we do, then? Shall we break off the discussion in the middle?
You'll have to decide that yourself.
But they say it isn't right to leave even stories half told. One has to put a head on them, so they don't go around headless. So answer the rest, so our discussion can get ahead.
How forceful you are, Socrates. If you'll take my advice, you'll let this discussion go, or else carry it on with someone else.
Then who else is willing? We surely shouldn't leave the discussion unfinished.
Couldn't you get through it yourself, either speaking on your own or answering yourself?
So that what Epicharmus said might come true for me, that I, being one man, become equal to what before took two men to say. Still, it looks like it will have to be this way of necessity. But if we do proceed like this, I think we should all be eager, out of love of the truth rather than love of winning, to find out what is true and what is false about the matters we're discussing, for it's a good shared by everyone that this become clear. I'll go through the argument then, as it seems to me to stand, and if any of you thinks I'm not agreeing with myself about what's really the case, you must object and refute me. For I'm not speaking as one who already knows what I'm saying, I'm searching together with you, so that if the person disputing with me says something that shows itself to be true, I'll be the first to agree. Still, I say this only if you think the argument should be carried through to the end. If you'd rather not, let's let it go now and leave.
But it doesn't seem right to me, Socrates, to leave yet. You should finish going through the argument. And it seems to me the others agree. I myself would like to hear you go through the rest of it yourself.
Well then, Gorgias, I too would gladly have kept on talking with Callicles here, until I'd given him Amphion's speech in return for Zethus's. But since you, Callicles, aren't willing to finish the argument with me, at least listen and correct me if you think I'm saying anything wrong. And if you refute me, I won't be angry with you the way you were with me. Instead, you'll be recorded in my book as my greatest benefactor.
Go on, my good man. Carry it through yourself.
Listen, then, as I take up the argument again from the beginning. Is the pleasant the same as the good? No, not the same, as Callicles and I agreed. Should the pleasant be pursued for the sake of the good, or the good for the sake of the pleasant? The pleasant for the sake of the good. And is the pleasant that by whose presence we feel pleasure, and the good that by whose presence we are good? Certainly. But surely we, and everything else that is good, are good by the presence of some excellence. That seems necessary to me, Callicles. But the excellence of each thing, of a tool, of a body, of a soul too, and of every living creature, doesn't come about in the finest way at random, but through order, correctness, and whatever skill has been assigned to each of them. Is that so? Yes, I say so. So the excellence of each thing is something ordered and arranged by order. I would say so. So it's some order coming to be in each thing proper to that thing that makes each of the things that exist good. That's how it seems to me. And so a soul that has its own proper order is better than one that lacks order. It must be. And surely a soul that has order is an orderly soul. How could it not be? And the orderly soul is temperate. That's absolutely necessary. So a temperate soul is good. I have nothing else to say against that, my dear Callicles. If you do, teach me.
Go on, my good mans.
I say that if the temperate soul is good, the soul in the opposite condition from the temperate one is bad. And that was the soul that is thoughtless and undisciplined. Certainly. And further, the temperate person would do what's fitting, both toward gods and toward men, since he wouldn't be temperate if he did what isn't fitting. That must be so. And further, in doing what's fitting toward men, he'd be acting justly, and toward the gods, piously. And a person who acts justly and piously must be just and pious. That's so. And he must also be courageous. It's not the mark of a temperate man to chase or flee whatever isn't fitting, but rather to flee and pursue whatever things and people and pleasures and pains he ought, and to hold his ground and endure where he must. So it's an absolute necessity, Callicles, that the temperate man being, as we've gone through, just and courageous and pious, is a completely good man. And that the good man does well and admirably whatever he does, and that the one who does well is blessed and happy, while the wicked man who does badly is wretched. And this last would be the man in the opposite condition from the temperate man, the undisciplined man, whom you were praising. So this is how I set the matter down, and I say these things are true. And if they're true, then anyone who wants to be happy must, it seems, pursue and practice temperance and flee undiscipline as fast as his legs will carry him, and arrange things so that above all he needs no punishing. But if he does need it, whether he himself or someone close to him, whether a private person or a city, then punishment and correction must be applied if he's going to be happy. This seems to me to be the goal a person should keep his eye on as he lives, directing everything of his own and of his cities toward this end, so that justice and temperance will be present in the man who's going to be blessed, acting this way, not letting his desires run undisciplined and trying to fill them up, an endless evil, living the life of a bandit. Such a man could never be dear to any other man, nor to a god, for he's incapable of partnership, and where there's no partnership, there's no friendship. The wise say, Callicles, that heaven and earth, gods and men, are held together by partnership and friendship and orderliness and temperance and justice. And that's why they call this whole thing a cosmos, an order, my friend, not a disorder or lack of discipline. But you seem to me not to pay attention to these things, wise as you are, and it has escaped your notice that geometric equality carries great power both among gods and among men, while you think one should practice getting more than one's share. You neglect geometry. Well then, either this argument of ours must be refuted, that the happy are happy by possessing justice and temperance, and the wretched are wretched through wickedness, or, if it's true, we must examine what follows from it. And everything that came before, Callicles, follows. The things you ask me about, whether I was speaking in earnest when I said that a man must accuse himself and his son and his friend if any of them does wrong, and that rhetoric must be used for this purpose. And the things you thought Polus conceded out of shame were true after all, that doing wrong is worse than suffering it, by exactly as much as it is more shameful. And that the man who's going to be a rhetorician in the true sense must be just and knowledgeable about just things, which, again, Polus said Gorgias admitted out of shame. Given that this is how things stand, let's examine what it is you keep reproaching me with, whether it's rightly said or not, that I'm incapable of helping myself or any of my friends or family, or of saving them from the greatest dangers, but am at the mercy of anyone who wants to treat me the way disenfranchised men are treated, at the mercy of whoever wishes, whether he wants to strike me, to use that vigorous phrase of yours, across the jaw, or to take my property, or to banish me from the city, or, worst of all, to kill me. And being in such a position is, on your account, the most shameful thing of all. But my position, which has already been stated many times, though nothing stops it being said again, is this. I do not say that being struck across the jaw unjustly is the most shameful thing, nor having my body or my purse cut open. Rather, striking and cutting me and mine unjustly is more shameful and worse, and stealing and enslaving and breaking into my house, and in short doing any wrong at all to me or mine, is worse and more shameful for the one doing the wrong than it is for me, the one wronged. These things, as I say, appeared to us up above in our earlier discussion, and they are held down and bound fast, if I may put it rather crudely, by arguments of iron and adamant, or so it would seem at least, and unless you or someone more vigorous than you unties them, it's impossible to speak well while saying anything other than what I'm saying now. For my part, my position is always the same. I don't know how these things really stand, but of everyone I've ever met, as now, no one has been able to say anything different without looking ridiculous. So again I set it down that this is how things are, and if that's so, and wrongdoing is the greatest of evils for the wrongdoer, and greater still, if such a thing is possible, is for the wrongdoer to escape paying the penalty for it, then what help would it be for a man who's unable to help himself and would truly be ridiculous for lacking? Isn't it the help that would turn aside the greatest harm to us? It's an absolute necessity that the most shameful kind of helplessness is being unable to help oneself or one's friends and family. Second worst is being unable to guard against the second greatest evil, and third against the third, and so on. The size of each evil determining, correspondingly, the nobility of being able to guard against it, and the shame of being unable to. Is that how it is, or not, Callicles?
It's not otherwise.
So there being two things, doing wrong and suffering wrong, we say doing wrong is the greater evil, suffering it the lesser. What then should a man equip himself with to help himself, so as to have both these benefits, the benefit of not doing wrong and the benefit of not suffering it? Is it power or is it will? Here's what I mean. If a man simply doesn't want to suffer wrong, will he not suffer it? Or must he acquire power to keep from suffering wrong in order not to suffer it?
That much is obvious, power.
And what about doing wrong? Is it enough if he doesn't want to do wrong, since then he won't do it? Or must he also acquire some power and skill for this, so that if he doesn't learn and practice it, he will do wrong? Why don't you answer me this very question, Callicles? Do you think Polus and I were right to be forced to agree, back in our earlier discussion, or not, when we agreed that no one does wrong willingly, but all who do wrong do it unwillingly?
Let's grant you that, Socrates, so you can finish your argument.
Then it seems that for this too we must equip ourselves with some power and skill, so that we don't do wrong.
Certainly.
What skill, then, is the skill of equipping oneself to suffer no wrong at all, or as little as possible? See if it seems the same to you as it does to me. To me, it seems this. Either one must rule in the city, even as a tyrant, or be a partner in whatever government is in power.
Do you see, Socrates, how ready I am to praise you when you say something well? This seems to me very well put.
Then consider this too, and see if it seems well put to me. Every man, I think, is as much a friend to another as possible according to the old saying of the wise, that like is dear to like. Don't you agree?
I do.
So where the ruler is a savage, uneducated tyrant, if there's someone in the city far better than he is, the tyrant would surely be afraid of him, and could never become his true friend, however he tried.
That's so.
Nor could someone far inferior become his friend either. The tyrant would look down on him, and would never take him seriously as a friend.
That's true too.
So the only friend left worth mentioning for such a man is someone of the same character, who blames and praises the same things, and is willing to be ruled and to submit to the ruler. This man will have great power in that city, and no one will wrong him and get away with it. Isn't that so?
Yes.
So if one of the young men in that city were to consider, how can I become powerful and how can no one wrong me? This, it seems, would be his path, to accustom himself from youth to take joy and offense in the same things as his master, and to arrange to be as much like him as possible. Isn't that right?
Yes.
So for this man, not being wronged and having great power in the city would be achieved, on your account.
Certainly.
But would he also avoid doing wrong? Far from it. If he's going to be like a ruler who is himself unjust and have great power with him. No, I think, on the contrary, his whole preparation will be aimed at being able to do as much wrong as possible and escape paying the penalty for it. Isn't that so?
So it seems.
So the greatest evil will befall him, being corrupt and maimed in soul through his imitation of his master and through his power.
I don't know how you keep turning the argument upside down and inside out, Socrates. Don't you know that this man who imitates the tyrant will kill the man who doesn't imitate him, if he wants to, and take away everything he has?
I know it, my good Callicles, unless I'm deaf. I've heard it just now from you and from Polus many times, and from just about everyone else in the city. But you listen to me too. He will kill him if he wants to, but he'll be a wicked man killing a fine, good man.
And isn't that exactly the outrageous part?
Not to a man of sense, at least, as the argument shows. Or do you think a person should arrange his life so as to live as long as possible and practice those skills that always save us from danger, the way you tell me to practice rhetoric, the kind that saves men in the law courts?
Yes, by Zeus, and I'm giving you good advice.
Well then, my excellent friend, does the skill of swimming strike you as anything impressive?
No, by Zeus, not to me.
And yet it too saves men from death, whenever they fall into the kind of situation that requires it. But if that seems too small a thing to you, I'll name you something greater, the pilot's skill, which saves not only lives but also bodies and property from the direst dangers, just as rhetoric does. And yet it's modest and orderly and doesn't put on airs as though it were doing something magnificent. But having accomplished the very same things as the skill of the law courts, if it brings you safely here from Aegina, I suppose it charges 2 obols. And if from Egypt or the Black Sea, then for this great benefit, saving, as I was just saying, the man himself and his children and property and wife. Having brought them safely into harbor, it charges 2 drachmas. And the man who has this skill and has accomplished all this steps off by the sea and walks beside his ship in a modest manner. He knows how to reckon, I think, that it's unclear which of his fellow passengers he benefited by not letting them drown, and which he harmed, since he knows he set them ashore no better than they were when they boarded, neither in body nor in soul. Does he not reckon it out like this? If a man is caught in some great incurable disease of the body. He isn't wretched merely because he wasn't drowned, and he gains nothing from being saved. But if a man has many incurable diseases in the part of him more precious than the body, namely the soul, then is this a man whose life is worth saving? And will you be doing him a favor by rescuing him, whether from the sea or from a courtroom or from anywhere else at all? No, he knows perfectly well that it is not better for a corrupt man to go on living, since he is bound to live badly. That is why there is no custom of the helmsman puffing himself up, even though he saves our lives, nor, my astonishing friend of the engineer, who can sometimes save lives that even a general, let alone a helmsman, cannot save. There are times he saves whole cities. Doesn't that strike you as being on a par with the courtroom lawyer? And yet, if he wanted to talk the way you people do, magnifying his craft, calicles, he would bury you in words, urging that everyone ought to become an engineer, since nothing else is worth anything. His argument would serve well enough. But you look down on him and his craft all the same, and you would fling engineer at someone as an insult, and you wouldn't be willing to give your daughter to his son, nor to take his daughter for yourself. And yet, given the grounds on which you praise your own qualities, what just argument do you have for despising the engineer and the others I mentioned just now? I know you would say you are better and from better stock. But if the better is not what I say it is, but is simply this, preserving oneself and one's belongings, whatever sort of person one happens to be, then your contempt becomes ridiculous, whether aimed at the engineer or the doctor or any of the other crafts that exist for the sake of preservation. No, my good man, consider whether the noble and the good might be something other than mere preserving and being preserved. Perhaps the true man ought not to worry about this at all, how long he lives, however long that turns out to be, and ought not to cling to life, but should leave that matter to God, trusting the women saying that no one can escape his fate, and should instead consider how he might live as well as possible in whatever time he has left to live, by making himself resemble the constitution he lives under. So it seems now, too, you must make yourself as much like the Athenian people as you can, if you mean to be dear to them and to have great power in the city. Consider whether this serves you well and me too, so that we don't suffer, my good friend, what they say happens to those women of Thessaly who pull down the moon. Choosing this power in the city will cost us the people we hold most dear. And if you imagine that anyone anywhere is going to hand you some craft that will make you powerful in this city while you remain unlike its constitution, whether for better or worse, then in my opinion you are planning badly, calicles. You must not merely imitate them, but be like them by nature, if you mean to produce anything genuine that wins the friendship of the Athenian people, and by Zeus, of Pyrrhalamps Circle too. Whoever makes you most like them will make you into the politician and orator you long to be. For people delight in speeches that match their own character and are irritated by anything foreign to it, unless you have something else to say, dear friend. Do we have any answer to this, Callicles?
I don't know how it is, Socrates, that you seem to speak well, yet I feel what most people feel. I'm not at all persuaded by you.
That's because love of the people, Callicles, sitting there in your soul, resists me. But if we examine these same questions often enough and better, perhaps you'll be persuaded. Remember, then, that we said there were two ways of tending to each thing, body and soul, one that deals in pleasure, the other aiming at what is best, not indulging but fighting for it. Weren't those the terms we set then?
Quite so.
And one of the two, the one aimed at pleasure, is base and nothing but flattery. Isn't that so?
Let it be so, if you like.
And the other aims at making whatever we tend, body or soul, as good as it can be.
Quite so.
Then is this the way we ought to go about tending to the city and its citizens, by trying to make the citizens themselves as good as possible? Without this, as we found earlier, There is no benefit in offering any other service at all, unless the intentions of those who mean to acquire great wealth, or office, or any other kind of power, are fine and good. Shall we say it stands this way?
Quite so, if it pleases you more.
Suppose, then, Callicles, that we were urging one another to take up public building projects, walls or dockyards or temples, the grandest structures. Shouldn't we first examine ourselves and ask whether we know the craft of building or not, and from whom we learned it? Shouldn't we?
Quite so.
And second, whether we had ever actually built anything privately for ourselves or a friend, and whether that building turned out handsome or ugly. And if, on examination, we found that we'd had good, reputable teachers, and had built many fine buildings together with our teachers, and many more on our own once we'd parted from them. In that condition, it would make sense for sensible men to move on to public works. But if we could point to no teacher of our own, and to buildings that were either non-existent or worthless, then surely it would be foolish to attempt public works and to urge one another into them. Shall we agree this is rightly said, or not?
Quite so.
And so it goes for everything else, including this. If we set out to serve the public as though we were competent doctors, surely I would examine you and you would examine me. By the gods, tell me, how is Socrates' own body with respect to health? Has anyone else, through Socrates, ever been freed from disease, slave or free? I imagine I would investigate the same sort of thing about you. And if we found that no one's body had been improved because of us, neither foreigners nor citizens, neither man's nor woman's, by Zeus, Callicles, wouldn't it truly be laughable that men should arrive at such a pitch of folly that, before practicing privately, doing much as it happened, succeeding at much, and getting sufficient practice at the craft, they should attempt, as the saying goes, to learn pottery on a wine jar, and both undertake public office themselves and urge others of the same kind to do so. Wouldn't it seem foolish to you to act that way?
It would to me.
But as things stand, best of men, since you yourself are just now beginning to take a hand in the city's affairs, and you urge me on and reproach me for not doing the same, shall we not examine one another? Come now. Has Callicles already made any citizen better? Is there anyone who was formerly wicked, unjust, undisciplined, foolish, who because of Callicles has become fine and good, foreigner or citizen, slave or free? Tell me, Callicles, if someone were to put this question to you, what would you say? Whom will you claim to have made better through association with you? Do you hesitate to answer, if indeed there is some deed of yours to point to while you were still a private man, before you undertook to enter public life?
You're eager to win, Socrates.
No, it's not eagerness to win that makes me ask, but a genuine wish to know in what manner you think one ought to conduct politics among us. Or will you, once you've entered on the city's affairs, take care of anything else besides making us citizens as good as possible? Haven't we already agreed many times that this is what the political man must do? We have agreed, haven't we? Answer. We have agreed. I'll answer on your behalf. If then this is what the good man must provide for his own city, cast your mind back now and tell me about those men you mentioned a little earlier. Do they still seem to you to have been good citizens? Pericles, Cimon, Miltiades, and Themistocles.
They do to me.
Then if they were good, clearly each of them made the citizens better instead of worse. Did they or not?
Yes.
So when Pericles first began speaking before the assembly, were the Athenians worse than when he gave his last speeches?
Perhaps.
Not perhaps, my good man. It follows necessarily from what we've agreed, if indeed that man was a good citizen.
Well, what of it?
Nothing, but tell me this next. Is it said that the Athenians became better because of Pericles, or quite the opposite, that they were corrupted by him? For what I hear is this, that Pericles made the Athenians idle, cowardly, chattering, and greedy for money, by being the first to establish payment for public service.
You're hearing that from people with their ears bashed in, Socrates.
But this next part I no longer merely hear. I know clearly, and so do you, that at first Pericles was held in high esteem, and the Athenians passed no shameful verdict against him, back when they were worse. But once they had become fine and good, thanks to him, at the very end of Pericles' life they convicted him of theft and came close to sentencing him to death, clearly treating him as a wicked man.
Well, was Pericles bad for that reason?
A keeper of donkeys or horses or cattle would certainly seem a bad one if he took them over not kicking or butting or biting and delivered them doing all of that out of sheer savagery. Or don't you think any keeper of any animal whatsoever is a bad one if he takes it over gentler and hands it back wilder than he received it? Do you think so or not?
I do, just to please you.
Then please me in this too by answering, is man one of the animals or not?
Of course he is.
And Pericles had care of men?
Yes.
Well then, shouldn't they, as we just agreed, have become more just instead of more unjust under him, if indeed he, being good at politics, was taking care of them?
Quite so.
And the just are gentle, as Homer said. What do you say, isn't that so?
Yes.
But in fact he made them wilder than when he took them over, and turned that wildness against himself, of all people, the last person he'd have wanted it turned against.
Do you want me to agree with you?
Only if you think I'm telling the truth.
So be it, then.
And if wilder, then also more unjust and worse.
So be it.
Then, on this reasoning, Pericles was not good at politics.
That's your claim, not mine.
No, by Zeus, it's yours too, from what you've agreed to. Now tell me again about Cimon. Didn't the very people he served ostracize him so as not to hear his voice for 10 years? And didn't they do the same to Themistocles, adding exile as a penalty? And didn't they vote to throw Miltiades, the hero of Marathon, into the pit, and would have, if not for the intervention of the presiding officer? And yet these men, if they had truly been good, as you claim, would never have suffered such things. Good charioteers don't get thrown from their chariots at the start. It's only after they've trained their horses and become better drivers themselves that they get thrown out. That isn't how it works, not in chariot driving nor in any other pursuit. Or do you think otherwise?
Not I.
So it seems our earlier conclusions were true after all, that none of us can name a single man who has proven himself a good statesman in this city. You agreed that none of the current ones qualify, but you picked out these men from the past instead. Yet they turn out to be no better than the men of today. So if they really were orators, they practiced neither the true art of rhetoric, for then they wouldn't have been driven out, nor the flattering kind.
But surely, Socrates, it's a long way from true that anyone alive today could match the achievements of whichever of those men you like.
My good man, I'm not faulting them as servants of the city. I actually think they served it better than today's men, and were more capable of supplying whatever the city desired. But when it comes to redirecting people's desires instead of just giving in to them, persuading and compelling the citizens toward whatever would actually make them better, in that respect, frankly, those men were no different at all. And that is the one true job of a good citizen. As for ships and walls and dockyards and all that sort of thing, I grant you those men were better at providing it than the men of today. So you and I are doing something absurd in this conversation. The whole time we've been talking, we keep circling back to the same point, never grasping what the other one means. I think you've admitted more than once, and you've recognized, that this business of caring for us comes in two forms, one for the body, one for the soul. One kind is a servant's job, able to supply, when our bodies hunger, food, when they thirst, drink, when they're cold, clothing, bedding, shoes, whatever else the body craves. I'm deliberately using the same images so you'll follow more easily. Anyone who can supply these things, whether a shopkeeper, a merchant, or a craftsman who makes them, a baker, a cook, a weaver, a cobbler, a tanner, it's no wonder such a person seems, to himself and to others, to be a caretaker of the body. That's true for anyone who doesn't know there's a further art, distinct from all these, gymnastic and medicine, which really is the genuine care of the body, and which rightly ought to govern all these other crafts and make use of their products, because it alone knows what food or drink is good or bad for the body's excellence, while all the rest are ignorant of that. That's why these other crafts are properly called slavish, servile, and unfree in their dealings with the body, while gymnastic and medicine are, by rights, their mistresses. Now, that the very same thing holds true for the soul, sometimes you seem to me to follow what I'm saying, and you agree as though you understood it. But then a little later you come back saying that certain men have proven themselves fine, upstanding citizens in this city. And when I ask who, you seem to me to be putting forward men who are exactly comparable in politics to what it would be if, when I asked about gymnastics, who has proven himself, or is a good caretaker of bodies, you told me, quite seriously, Therion the baker and Mythicus, who wrote the book on Sicilian cooking, and Sarambus the wine merchant. That these men have proven themselves marvelous caretakers of bodies, one supplying wonderful bread, another delicacies, another wine. You'd probably be offended if I said to you, "My friend, you understand nothing about gymnastics. You're telling me about servants, men who cater to appetites, who understand nothing fine or good about the body itself, men who, if things go that way, stuff and fatten people's bodies and get praised for it, while actually destroying even the flesh they started with. And the people in their ignorance won't blame those who feasted them for their illnesses and for the loss of their original good health. No, they'll blame whoever happens to be standing nearby giving advice, whenever the earlier overindulgence brings on sickness much later since it came about with no regard for health. Those people they'll blame, find fault with, and harm if they can, while the earlier ones, the true causes of the harm, they'll praise to the skies. And that, Callicles, is exactly what you're doing now. You praise men who feasted the citizens, gorging them on whatever they craved. And people say those men made the city great, not noticing that it's bloated and festering underneath, thanks to those men of old. For without self-control and justice they filled the city up with harbors and dockyards and walls and tribute and all that kind of nonsense. So when the collapse comes, brought on by this underlying weakness, people will blame whoever happens to be advising them at the time, and praise Themistocles and Cimon and Pericles, the very men who caused the trouble. And perhaps they'll come after you too, if you're not careful, and my friend Alcibiades, when they start losing even what they originally had, on top of what they've gained since, though you two aren't really the cause of the harm, only perhaps accomplices in it. And yet I see this same foolish thing happening now, and I hear it happened with the men of old too. Whenever the city moves against one of its statesmen as a wrongdoer, I notice they get indignant and complain bitterly about how unjustly they're being treated, as if, having done the city so much good, they're now being destroyed by it unfairly. But the whole thing is a lie, because no leader of a city could ever be unjustly destroyed by the very city he leads. Politicians who merely claim to be statesmen, it seems, are really no different from sophists. Sophists, too, wise as they are in other respects, do this strange thing, while claiming to be teachers of virtue. They often turn around and accuse their own students of wronging them, cheating them out of their fees or otherwise showing no gratitude, despite having been well treated by them. But could anything be more illogical than that argument, that men who have become good and just, having had injustice removed from them by their teacher and having gained justice instead, should then use that very justice to do wrong, when they no longer have injustice in them to do it with? Doesn't that strike you as absurd, my friend? You've truly forced me into making speeches, Callicles, by refusing to answer.
And you couldn't talk if no one answered you.
It seems I can right now, at least. I'm stretching my arguments out at length, since you won't answer me. But my good man, tell me, in the name of Zeus Philios, doesn't it seem irrational to you for someone to claim he's made another person good, and then blame that very person because, having been made good and being good, he later turns out bad?
It seems so to me.
Then don't you hear people who claim to educate men in virtue saying exactly that kind of thing?
I do, but why should you bother talking about men who aren't worth anything?
And what would you say about those who claim to lead the city and take care that it becomes as good as possible, and then turn around and accuse it, whenever it suits them, of being utterly corrupt? Do you think they're any different from the sophists? A sophist and an orator are really the same thing, my good man, or nearly the same in close kin, just as I said to Polus. But out of ignorance you think one of them, rhetoric, is something splendid, while you look down on the other. In truth, though, sophistry is as much finer than rhetoric as lawgiving is finer than judging cases, and gymnastic finer than medicine. I used to think that only public speakers and sophists were in no position to complain about the very thing they themselves teach, as if it were somehow harmful to them, because doing so would, in the same breath, be an accusation against themselves, admitting they had done no good for the very people they claim to have benefited. Isn't that so?
Quite so.
And presumably, it would also make sense that only these same people could reasonably offer their services for free, without a fee, if what they claimed were true. Someone who's been helped in some other way, say, made fast through the trainer's teaching, might perhaps cheat the trainer out of his due thanks, if the trainer gave the training away without first agreeing on a fee to be paid alongside the speed. For it's not through slowness, I think, that people do wrong, but through injustice. Isn't that right?
Yes.
So if someone removes this very thing, injustice, from a person, there's no danger that person will ever be wronged because of it. It's the one and only benefit that can safely be given away for free if someone really is capable of making people good. Isn't that so?
I agree.
That's why, it seems, there's nothing shameful in charging money for other kinds of advice, about building houses, say, or other crafts.
So it seems.
But when it comes to this particular matter, how a person might become as good as possible and best manage his own household or city, it's considered shameful to refuse advice unless someone pays for it. Isn't that so?
Yes.
Clearly the reason is that this is the only kind of benefit that makes the person who received it want to do good in return, so that it seems a good sign if, having done this favor, one receives a favor back in return and a bad sign if not. Is that how things stand?
They do.
Then tell me clearly which kind of care for the city you're inviting me to practice. Draw the line for me. The kind that fights constantly with the Athenians to make them as good as possible, like a doctor, or the kind that serves them and speaks only to please them. Tell me the truth, Callicles, you're obliged to, since you started out being frank with me, so keep saying what you actually think. Speak now, plainly and nobly.
Well then, I say the kind that serves them.
So you're inviting me to flatter them, my noble friend.
If you'd rather I call it something cruder, Socrates, because if you don't do that.
Don't repeat what you've already said so many times that anyone who wants to can kill me so that I don't in turn say, a bad man killing a good one, and don't say he'll take my property so that I don't in turn say, well, having taken it unjustly, he won't know what to do with it. But just as he took it from me unjustly, he'll use it unjustly too. And if unjustly, then shamefully, and if shamefully, then badly.
You really seem to me, Socrates, to believe none of this could happen to you, as if you lived somewhere out of reach, and could never be hauled into court by some thoroughly wicked, worthless man.